this crazy town having hard times. There's no love to be found. So many hard times.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Dinges, who is a former managing editor at NPR News and now professor and director of radio at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism, as well as co-founder of the Centro de Investigación e Información Periodista in San Diego, Chile, and executive director of the nonprofit Center for Investigation and Information. He's the author of Sound Reporting, the NPR Guide to Radio Reporting and Production, Independence and Integrity, a Guidebook for Public Radio Journalism. And his latest book is The Condor Years, How Pinochet and His Allies Brought Terrorism to Three Continents. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Dinges.
Yeah, well, thanks. Good to be here.
And there's an article in Wednesday's New York Times about WBAI-FM in New York, a sister station of our station here, KPFK in Los Angeles, and on how much endangered it is and how much the Pacifica network itself is endangered. And the article comes to the conclusion that Pacifica is governing itself to death. As somebody with a long history with public radio, and by the way, NPR itself seems to be having management problems, at least a lot of turnover, how do you see the public radio spectrum at this moment?
Pacifica has always been a vital part of public radio. And those of us who have been in public radio for a long time view it with much affection and sympathy. And, of course, my perspective is the NPR perspective. We are, when I was there, and I still teach NPR public radio type journalism, it intends to be mainstream journalism and doesn't intend to be an alternative to the mainstream. And so Pacifica's importance is all that much greater because we need a variety of voices. We need journalism that's different. And as much as I love NPR, what you do on Pacifica definitely brings in voices that are not heard on NPR. So it's really with sadness that I observed the decline of WBAI in New York, and I guess WPFW here in Washington is also having big problems.
And you're quoted in this New York Times article about Pacifica saying a democracy may prove the doom of WBAI, referring to Amy Goodman's program Democracy Now!, which is the biggest creditor. They owe Democracy Now! $2 million. You're saying Pacifica has fallen below the level of sustainability and the size of its audience.
Yeah, that's what I say in the article. Somebody else made the point about the democracy being the doom of Pacifica, which I guess I agree with. But I was making the point that you have to have a audience that is big enough day in, day out, hour in, hour out, to keep people coming and to build audience during the day. And that audience is going to be, in the public radio model, is going to be your support. And if you fall below a certain minimum, and I understand that WBAI has fallen very, very low, even with Amy Goodman's show, which is the most popular show that they have on the air, it's, I guess, below 1,000 day average quarter hour. They cited ratings as 0.1%. I mean, my understanding is that it doesn't show up on Arbitron if you try to measure the audience of WBAI. It's disappearing. And so there are a few, you know, 1,000 or so very loyal members who are being asked over and over again to contribute. And they have done that bravely, but with that small a membership and with an audience that is so small, it's difficult to maintain the public radio model of listener support.
And, of course, the Arbitrons are the radio's equivalent of the Nielsen ratings. And again, I'm speaking with John Dinges, who's a former managing editor at NPR News, now professor and director of radio at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism, as well as a co-founder of the Centro de Investigación e Información Periodística in Santiago, Chile, and executive director of the nonprofit Center for Investigation and Information. And he's the author of Sound Reporting, the NPR Guide to Radio Reporting and Production, Independence and Integrity, A Guidebook for Public Radio Journalism. And his latest book is The Condor Years, How Pinochet and His Allies Brought Terrorism to Three Continents. So it does, it strikes me as an irony, and I wonder if it strikes you as an irony, that the revolution that took place about 13 years ago, the Free Pacific Movement, which was largely precipitated by the firing of Amy Goodman at WBAI, and she led the revolution, I think, for all intents and purposes, that...
I didn't understand that was what happened. I thought it was the... And I wrote an article at the time in The Nation, and my understanding was that the revolution was against Mary Berry as the chairman of the Pacifica Board.
Right, but one of her actions was to fire Amy, apparently. And
I thought she went on her own, but then maybe I'm wrong on that.
Right.
I thought she handled it very adroitly and managed to emerge stronger from the crisis, whereas the rest of Pacifica was weaker. But
well, that's true. And that's why it's so ironic to think that the New York Times are saying that Democracy Now! May prove to be the doom of WBAI.
Well, but Democracy Now! Has a debt with WBAI. I'm sorry, the other way around, that WBAI owes money to the Amy Goodman Show. And I don't think that that's something that is going to cause the doom of WBAI. I can't speak for her, but I certainly it's in her interest, it's in her company's interest to help WBAI survive. And if you've got your debt with somebody, it would be certainly good to have it with the friend who hopefully will negotiate it. I don't know the status of that, but my feeling would be that there's the makings of a deal. That's the least of WBAI's problems, the debt with the Amy Goodman Show. I think the biggest problem is the lack of a stream of income from its members because of the declining listenership. And the listenership is, I mean, that's the thing that I most know about, which is radio programming and how you attract audience and how you keep audience. And that, to me, is the most important thing because, after all, if people are not listening, none of it matters.
Well, it does seem that the interim director of Pacifica, the Pacifica Foundation, Summer Rees, in the New York Times article on Wednesday, she's quoted as saying that she wants to tame the finances, improve programming, and rewrite the bylaws from scratch. And, of course, these board elections, which are held 2 out of every 3 years, the last one cost $231,000, and Pacifica still has $100,000 in legal bills, many from lawsuits originating from these elections. It sounds like at least she is focused on where the real problems are, and that's the paradox of this revolution to free Pacifica. It burdened it with onerous bylaws and an election. And here at KPFK in Los Angeles, by the way, the listeners have sent us a strong message by boycotting the elections, in effect. It didn't even reach quorum, and that's been the case all along, that they've had problems reaching a 10% quorum of voters. So, I mean, it seems reasonable to me that the public want good programs. They don't want to have to, you know, that's what they want. Isn't that the formula that Lou Hill came up with that became the basis of public radio? You pay for what you like?
Exactly. And the idea that every person and their associated movement or cause should be able to translate your membership in Pacifica into putting your cause on the air, it leads to a balkanization of the programming. And that, you know, might be okay for a political coalition, but that's deadly for a radio broadcast because you don't have any choice when you're listening to the radio. You have to listen to what is being presented. And so skillful programmers present something that from 1 hour to the next, from one part of the day to the next, is attractive to increasing numbers of people. Rather than, okay, I'm interested in 1 hour a week, but the rest of the time it's not my cause and so I'm really not interested. So that kind of atomized or balkanized programming in which everybody's interest has its own half hour or hour is predictably not producing a sustained listenership. I think, you know, I don't know what the programming is like at KPFK and KPFA, but I understand that you don't have that problem and that you're doing much better.
Well, yes, and I think KPFK's case success has led to a lot of resources being diverted to these sinking ships at the BAI and in Washington, which is, explains why we have so many frequent fund drives. So nobody in this network appears to be immune from the problems that New York and Washington, D.C. have. And I guess, again, that all goes back to what came out of this revolution about 13 years ago. And again, in the article, the new interim director of Pacifica, Summer Rees, is saying that, you know, unless Pacifica reforms, it will simply govern itself to death. Quoting her, this is what the board does. It fiddles while Rome burns. So it's it's an odd situation to be a programmer on the air and to be somewhat helpless about your own governance, you know?
Yeah, I watched that happening back at the time that I wrote the article, and I watched the demise of Pacifica Radio News, Pacifica News Service, I can't remember the name of it, which was a very respectable news service with reporters in several cities, and they were doing, I think, a half-hour program of high-quality news, and all of that was eliminated by the revolution and replaced with, you know, some volunteer programming and things like that. But essentially, I mean, be that as it may, if you're going to run something for the service of the listeners, you have to have your eye on the listeners and not on the individual interests of everybody who wants to do their program. The test should always be, we welcome ideas. There should be a, you know, a rainfall of ideas, but only those ideas that are successful in attracting listenership and are compatible with a broad swath of listeners across your program, across your schedule, should be the ones that are allowed to stay on the air. Because otherwise, you have a zero, you have a declining returns on each program. Every program attracts a little audience, but the next hour is so different from the first hour that the people in the second hour are not interested in the first, and the people in the first are not interested in the second, and everybody goes away. You know, in radio, that's a basic principle, that you have to have programming that builds rather than detracts.
Well, indeed, I think having been a witness to this revolution and the damage that it's done over the last 13 years, where we've lost over half to three-quarters of our audience, and we lost an enormous amount of audience when they arbitrarily shifted to doing nighttime broadcasting in the Spanish language. So a lot of people just assumed.
That's a good example.
They just assumed that the station had gone Spanish and that was the end of it. They never came back. And the rest of the program still subsidized the Spanish programming, even though we are in a community where there are millions of unserved Spanish-speaking people, and that's the rationale for doing it. But the programs that we have are clearly failing because they have fewer people listening to them than they do have members of the collectives that produce them. I mean, you talk about WBI having a cume of, 1,000 listeners. According to the fundraising figures for Spanish language broadcasting, they must have about 10 listeners, you know?
Yeah, I mean, obvious, if you looked at the radio programming environment, the Los Angeles area has many, many successful Spanish language radio stations. And so the alternatives to the whatever Spanish language programming you do on your station are many and probably very high quality. And it's all day in Spanish. And so it's not surprising that the immense majority of people who want to hear programming in Spanish are listening someplace else.
Well, I mean, the idea is a noble one and a good one, and there obviously is an unmet need. It's just the execution appears to be a total failure. And of course, nobody wants to look at the execution. They keep talking about the idea itself. That's the excuse, if you know what I mean.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, it stops with it being a good idea, as you said, and does not translate into execution that is proven by results. Meaning, if you're not attracting an audience with your Spanish programming, change the programming and keep changing it until you really have an audience. And if you never can attract an audience, well, maybe that's a sign that you should be going doing something else. But you always have to test what you're doing by saying, am I serving significant numbers of people, not just the people putting on the programming.
But the board structure and the bylaws since its revolution make what is going on in the corridors and in the meetings, the endless meetings that people have in this building, more important than what goes out over the air. So you can't make the arguments that you're making. You'll be called a racist.
Or a fascist, or, yeah, right. I've been in those meetings, but maybe there's a way to, what do you think, that there's a way out of this impasse at Pacifica? Is there a way to change the governance so it will become less divisive and
burdensome,
more rational and more kind of mainstream?
Well, I think that if the management takes the cue from our listeners who are effectively boycotting these elections, saying we don't want to deal with this stuff, you know, by not reaching the 10% quorum, I think that's a place to start. Now, you obviously have to think about what kind of a board structure you need to replace this onerous one that we have that's clearly not working and that they don't raise money, by the way. None of these people on the board raise money like normal boards do. And the fellow that started it all, who I might add committed suicide, Lou Hill, you know, he had believed there was no need for an infrastructure, that it could sort of run itself. So I guess you'd have to have, an appointed board. I mean, I'm just thinking off the top of my head.
Well, I mean, there's the non-profit structure.
Like the Guardian, that's a great model, yeah.
You're a 501c3,
right.
Which has tax advantages. And I actually, one of the things that you quoted in my bio is a nonprofit, the Center for Investigation and Information. And it's very simple. There's a board of people, and you have to trust the people on the board that they're there for the good of the institution and that board rotates, you know, changes through the years.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically is in charge of its own future. And obviously, that was the structure that they rejected because they said that the board members were not responsible to the listeners.
Sure.
But I think what they meant by listeners were themselves, those who were leading the revolution.
Right. And now the irony is that the very nemesis of the revolution, which was the idea that they were going to sell these licenses to corporate interests, which was a complete lie, no evidence was ever furnished. Now they're talking about the possibility of selling this valuable license in New York. So even a greater irony. But just in closing, John Dingers, just to broaden it out to public radio itself, I'm always astounded that there are over 1,000 college and community radio stations in this country, many of them extremely impoverished. Many of them cannot afford the NPR feeds, as a matter of fact.
Right.
And yet they are completely inchoate. There's a potential network there. And if you're a Time Warner cable customer, as I am, you know, you are getting a real wake-up call about commercial mainstream media in the sense that these big media moguls that control the spectrum and control the pipe into your house, they can pull the plug because they're having a snit with another company. But that doesn't make you very secure about the future of media.
I'm sure you're watching what's happening with the launch of Al Jazeera, and one of those cable providers pulled the plug on them. As soon as the signal was switched from current TV to Al Jazeera, one of the cable companies owned by AT&T took them out of their cable lineup. So that's the danger, as you say, of these very large corporations controlling the pipeline of media into our house. But there is a silver lining, which is that we are now increasingly able to access really good programming. I'm talking about TV, but, you know, radio as well, without buying the cable. And many, many people are cutting the cable and accessing through their computers and through Apple TV and things like that. And, you know, that's really encouraging because I'm not being Pollyannish because I'm very concerned about the de-democratization of American media, but at least that trend is going in the other direction, that it gives people alternatives to find good quality media and to do it without paying $150 a month.
Well, John Dingers, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
Again, I've been speaking with John Dinges, who is a former managing editor at NPR News, now a professor and director of radio at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism, as well as co-founder of the Centro de Investigación e Información Periodística in San Diego, Chile, and executive director of the nonprofit Center for Investigation and Information. He's the author of Sound Reporting, the NPR Guide to Radio Reporting and Production, Independence and Integrity, a guidebook for public radio journalism, and his latest book is The Condor Years, How Pinochet and His Allies Brought Terrorism to Three Continents. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking with the journalist who has kicked off RT, Russia's English language cable network, for attacking Putin's anti-gay crackdown.